circles, a number of whom were Jews, who, Adams later said, were among the most liberal and accommodating of all. He made a study of Dutch ways and temperament, read deeply in Dutch history, searching out ever more volumes in Amsterdam's numerous well-stocked bookshops. He struggled to learn the language, and in what seemed an equally daunting task, to fathom the complexities of the Dutch system of government. Between times, he kept campaigning by mail for an American navy, his determination perhaps reinforced by a new appreciation of all that commerce at sea had meant to the Dutch. "If I could have my will, there should not be the least obstruction of navigation, commerce, or privateering," Adams wrote to Benjamin Rush, "because I firmly believe that one sailor will do us more good than two soldiers." To Congress, he declared emphatically, "A navy is our natural and only defense." In October, events took an unexpected turn, when word came from London that Henry Lawrence, on his way to Amsterdam, had been captured at sea by a British man of war. Charged with high treason, Lawrence was being held prisoner in the Tower of London, with orders that no person whatever speaks to him, as Adams's London contact Thomas Diggs reported. A sack containing Lawrence's confidential papers had been thrown overboard from his ship too late, and the British had hooked it from the sea. Among the papers was the draft of a proposed secret treaty between America and the Netherlands, a document of no real significance, but one the British were happy to use as a pretext for a show of angry indignation and threats of war, a possibility the Dutch dreaded as they did no other. With the responsibility of securing a loan now squarely on his shoulders, and the likelihood of peace no nearer than before, Adams settled in for the long haul. At home, the war in the South was going badly. Charleston had fallen to the British. At Camden, South Carolina, General Horatio Gates had suffered a devastating defeat in a battle in which American soldiers had fled like sheep. Nearly 1,000 Americans had been killed, and 1,000 more captured. Gates had been a favorite general officer of the Congress and of Adams, and it had been one of the most disastrous defeats of the war. "But there must be no softening of resolve," Adams declared. "I think I see very clearly that America must grow up in war," he wrote to Congress. His own central task was to convince the Dutch that America would accept no outcome short of complete, irrevocable independence. Without that insurance, there would be no Dutch loan. Of this, Adams was now absolutely certain. "This country has been grossly deceived. It has little knowledge of the numbers, wealth, and resources of the United States, and less faith in their finally supporting independence, upon which alone a credit depends. They also have an opinion of the power of England vastly higher than the truth. Measures must be taken with great caution and delicacy to undeceive them." With his phenomenal capacity for work, an attribute not lost on the industrious Dutch, he produced materials of every kind in an all-out effort to undeceive them, while at the same time providing Congress with some of the most astute political reporting of his diplomatic career. Help came from a number of his new Dutch friends, people of the first character, as he said, who saw in the American struggle for independence hope for all humanity, and who, as Adams would long contend, never received the recognition they deserved. Charles W. F. Dumas was a Dutch radical and friend of Franklin, a schoolmaster, linguist, and man of letters. Older than Adams by nearly 15 years, he served faithfully as a translator and expert source of information. John Luzac of Leiden, a lawyer, scholar, and editor, published in his Gazette de Leyde a steady variety of materials supplied by Adams, including the first European translation of the new Massachusetts Constitution, which was to have an important effect in the Netherlands. In little time, Luzzach and Adams became the closest of friends. Baron Johan Dirk von der Capellen Tot den Pol, a Dutch nobleman, had been the first and most prominent figure in the country to champion the American cause, and he greatly admired Adams's determination. Von der Capellen knew the majority of the Dutch sympathized with the American Revolution, but astutely he advised Adams that only American success in the war would enlist Dutch credit for all the expressions of goodwill and interest he would hear. At The Hague, as Adams came to understand, there was little sympathy for the American cause, nor much hope for decisive action. The government of the country, maddeningly complicated to anyone unfamiliar with it, seemed devised intentionally to foster inertia. It was a republic, but with no real executive power, only a symbolic head of state, the hereditary stadtholder William V, Prince of Orange, who was related to the British royal family and personally devoted to the status quo. As Adams explained to Congress, sovereignty resided in the National Assembly, their high mightinesses, the States General. Yet even they were but the deputies of the regents in the cities, a very select group of great influence. Thus, as Adams wrote, the true power lay in the cities and in Amsterdam in particular. The burgomasters of Amsterdam, who are called the Regency, are one integral branch of the sovereignty of the seven United Provinces, and the most material branch of all because the city of Amsterdam is one quarter of the whole republic, at least in taxes. Not until the government at The Hague took it upon itself to recognize the United States would anyone in the government be permitted to receive Adams officially. In actual practice, nearly all would shun him. This being the case, it seemed only sensible to concentrate his efforts in Amsterdam, as both the money and the real political power were there. But as Adams found, Dutch talk of financial support and an actual Dutch loan were decidedly different matters, his initial high expectations to the contrary. "No banking house that I have as yet thought it prudent to apply to dares to undertake the trust," he told Congress. The Netherlands had been too long allied with Britain as a matter of commercial advantage. Dutch prosperity depended in large measure on British support for Dutch trade on the high seas. Dutch banks, moreover, held substantial loans to Britain. Hence, there was extreme reluctance to take any step, do anything rash, that might upset the British. That November of 1780, the situation was further compounded by more dispiriting news from America. In September, General Benedict Arnold had conspired to commit treason, to turn over the fortress at West Point to the British, and when found out, defected to the enemy. As Baron von der Capellen reported to Adams, Arnold's treachery on top of the loss of Charleston and Gates's defeat at Camden left Dutch confidence shattered. "Never has the credit of America stood so low," he told Adams, who advised Congress to depend upon no money from hence. All professions of Dutch friendship for America were but little adulations to procure a share of our trade. And now even they had vanished like a vapor, as had his own prior exuberance and admiration for the Dutch. A hard North Sea winter set in to match Adams's mood. Days were bitterly cold and raw, with darkness descending at 4 in the afternoon, and the air of Amsterdam thick with chimney smoke. With the canals frozen, thousands of skaters took to the ice, a spectacle that provided what little cheer Adams found in life. His health was suffering. He worried about his sons. At the Latin school, because he spoke no Dutch, John Quincy had been placed with elementary students. The boy grew restless and disheartened. The rector of the school thought him impertinent and merited a thrashing, as he informed his father. Adams's response was exactly what his own father's would have been. "Send the boys to me this evening," he answered. He had no wish to see his children subjected to such littleness of soul, he explained to Abigail in a letter in which he gave vent not only to his indignation at the schoolmaster, but at what he had come to see as a decidedly unattractive side to the Dutch character that he had no desire to see rub off on his sons. "The masters are mean-spirited wretches, punching, kicking, and boxing the children upon every turn," he wrote. No longer did he see the Dutch as examples to the world, but perceived now, bitterly, a general littleness arising from the incessant contemplation of stivers and doits, pennies and nickels, which pervades the whole people. Frugality and industry were virtues everywhere, but avarice and stinginess were not frugality. "The Dutch say that without a habit of thinking of every doit before you spend it, no man can be a good merchant or conduct trade with success. This, I believe, is a just maxim in general, but I would never wish to see a son of mine govern himself by it. It is the sure and certain way for an industrious man to be rich. It is the only possible way for a merchant to become the first merchant or the richest man in the place. But this is an object that I hope none of my children will ever aim at." Through a young American named Benjamin Waterhouse, a student of medicine at the University of Leiden, Adams arranged for tutors for the two boys and the opportunity for them to attend lectures at the university. Such was the turmoil of Amsterdam that Adams now found it impossible even to arrange meetings. "Very few dare to see me," he reported. Searching desperately for a sign that all was not lost, the best he could come up with was the popularity of new songs full of patriotic resentment toward the English. A woman who sang one such song on an Amsterdam street corner sold 600 copies in an hour, he informed Congress. But the hard truth was that after 5 months in the Dutch Republic, Adams had yet to meet a single government official of any importance. In December, the veteran British ambassador to the Netherlands, Sir Joseph York, began openly threatening the Dutch, setting off something very like panic. "War is to a Dutchman the greatest of evils," Adams wrote. "York is so sensible of this that he keeps alive a continual fear of it." At year's end, the high and mighty York abruptly departed, and Britain commenced an undeclared war on Dutch shipping. Convinced he must now gain recognition of American independence and arrange a Dutch-American alliance, and thus only, he had concluded, could he obtain a loan, Adams pressed Congress for greater authority. As winter progressed, his new commission arrived. Congress had designated him Minister Plenipotentiary to the Dutch Republic, which provided all the authority to be wished for. Through February and March, despite the weather, Adams kept on the move, traveling back and forth between Amsterdam, Leiden, and The Hague, conferring with as many of his Dutch friends and contacts as possible. Again, as at Paris, the question was the timing of a formal announcement of his new powers. Advised that his Amsterdam lodgings were too obscure for his new position, and that his effectiveness was being hurt by talk of this, Adams arranged for an American firm in Amsterdam to hire a suitable house. "The best house that is to be had at as cheap a rate as may be," he wrote, "and to have it furnished decent enough for any character in Europe to dine in with a Republican citizen." In lengthy correspondence on the matter, he specified that the house be large, roomy, and handsome, fit for the Hôtel des États-Unis d'Amérique. He would need two manservants and a good cook, whether male or female, he did not care. A genteel carriage would be required, as well as a coachman, and Adams was particular that the livery be in the Paris mode. Deep blue coat and breeches, scarlet cape, and waistcoats. He also wanted the clothes returned when the time came for the servants to leave. This was new work for him, he added, having never set up housekeeping before. At Versailles, meanwhile, the Comte de Vergennes was writing to his ambassador at Philadelphia to say that Adams, in his role in the Netherlands, had become an embarrassment, an observation that La Luzerne was expected to pass along to his numerous friends in Congress. Especially distressing to Vergennes was the thought of Adams ever having any say in a peace settlement. He has a rigidity, an arrogance, and an obstinacy that will cause him to foment 1,000 unfortunate incidents. By established diplomatic form, no emissary ever proclaimed his mission, his public character, until the government to which he was accredited was ready to receive him. To do otherwise was deemed not only appallingly bad form, but altogether impractical. By the time spring came, Adams had decided what he must do, no matter the diplomatic niceties. "America has been too long silent in Europe," he wrote to Francis Dana. "Her cause is that of all nations and all men, and it needs nothing but to be explained, to be approved." Adams was by then at Leiden, settled temporarily with his sons, John Thaxter, and Benjamin Waterhouse, the medical student, in a house on a narrow street behind the Peterskirk, the city's famous cathedral on the opposite side of the Rappenburg Canal from the university. It was the old quarter where the Pilgrims had lived during their years at Leiden, a connection deeply felt by Adams. A deacon at the cathedral would later relate, "Mr. Adams could not refrain from tears in contemplating this great structure." On April 19, 1781, 6 years to the day from the Battle of Lexington and Concord, Adams completed and signed a 16-page memorial addressed to "Their High Mightinesses, the States General of the United Provinces of the Low Countries." A strong, even passionate, appeal for cooperation. It began by affirming that the American people were unalterably determined to maintain their independence, and that if ever there was a natural alliance, it would be between the two republics of the Netherlands and the United States. He recalled the years of asylum that the Pilgrims had found among the Dutch. He recounted how New York and New Jersey had been first settled by the Dutch, whose descendants and customs remained. Indeed, so close were the two republics in history, religion, and government, Adams declared, that every Dutchman instructed on the subject must pronounce the American Revolution just and necessary, or pass a censure upon the greatest actions of his immortal ancestors. And if such bold sentiments were not reason enough for a Dutch-American bond, there was the great and growing interest of commerce, the circumstance which perhaps in this age has stronger influence than any other in the formation of friendships between nations. It may not be amiss to hint that the central situation of this country, her extensive navigation, her possessions in the East and West Indies, the intelligence of her merchants, the number of her capitalists, and the riches of her funds, render a connection with her very desirable to America. And, on the other hand, the abundance and variety of the productions of America, the materials of manufacturers, navigation, and commerce, the vast demand and consumption in America of the manufactures of Europe, cannot admit of a doubt that a connection with the United States would be useful to this republic. Adams was acutely aware of the magnitude of the step he was taking. By breaking the rules of diplomatic convention, by embarking on his own on what he called militia diplomacy, He was, he knew, risking ridicule and enmity, and in the event that things went sour, disgrace. His entire mission was at stake, and who could say what the consequences would be at home if it were to fail? But wise men know, he would write, that militia sometimes gain victories over regular troops, even by departing from the rules. It was the militia, after all, who had humiliated the British regulars at Lexington and Concord on that earlier April 19th. For a man of such strong feelings and great inner tensions, these were days of extreme stress, during which he remained uncharacteristically silent, as Benjamin Waterhouse would recall in a telling description of Adams the morning he set off for The Hague, 9 miles distant. "I shall never forget the day and the circumstances of Mr. Adams's going from Leyden to The Hague with the memorial to their high mightinesses, the States General. He came down into the front room where we were, his secretary, 2 sons, and myself, his coach and 4 at the door, and he, fully dressed even to his sword, when with energetic countenance and protuberant eyes and holding his memorial in his hand, said to us in a solemn tone, 'Young men, remember this day, for this day I go to The Hague to put seed in the ground that may produce good or evil, God knows which.' And putting the papers in his side pocket, he stepped into his coach and drove off alone, leaving us, his juniors, solemnized in thought and anxious, for he had hardly spoken to us for several days before. Such was his inexpressible solitude. At The Hague, Adams called first on the French ambassador, the young Duc de la Vauguyon, to inform him of his plan to present the memorial as soon as possible. La Vauguyon, a plump and personable young man whom Adams genuinely liked, spent the next several hours trying to dissuade him, urging that at the least he wait for an opinion from Vergennes. Adams refused. When the following morning La Vauguyon appeared at Adams's hotel to renew his plea, Adams again refused. He knew perfectly well that Vergennes would decide against him, Adams said, and there was no time to be lost. "What?" said the Duke, according to Adams's later rendition of the scene. "Will you take responsibility of it upon yourself?" "Indeed, Monsieur le Duc, I will. And I think I alone ought to be responsible, and that no other ambassador, minister, council, or court ought to be answerable for anything concerning it." "Are you then determined?" "Determined and unalterably determined I am." On Friday, May 4th, 1781, at the Binnenhof, the inner courts at The Hague, Adams called on the Baron von Linden von Hemmen, president of the States General for that week, and presented his memorial. And with the energetic help of Dumas and Lezac, Adams had already arranged for its publication in English, French, and Dutch, which was no less important. Thousands of printed copies were made immediately available. Newspapers were provided with the full text. In little time it appeared throughout Europe. That accomplished, Adams could do no more but wait for a reaction from the Dutch government. "They will deliberate and deliberate and deliberate," he wrote in despair, little imagining how right he was. He had been away from home now for more than a year, leaving Abigail to face 2 winters without him, the first of which had been the most severe in 40 years. Her letters had never stopped, one season to another, though they arrived sporadically and were nearly always 5 or 6 months out of date. She wrote to him about the war and the severe weather. Sadly, she related the deaths of his brother Peter's wife, Mary, and of his mother's husband, John Hall. His mother, she wrote, desires her tenderest regards to you, though she fears she shall not live to see your return. Other letters were taken up with business-like requests for trade goods, as Adams was again supplying her with regular shipments. She ordered silk gloves, ribbon, thread, fans, common calico, and handkerchiefs. Handkerchiefs will turn to good account for hard money, she reminded him. Only once did she request something for herself, a green umbrella from Paris. As she herself acknowledged, she found it impossible to write a short letter. And to John Quincy and Charles came pages dispensing vigorous, motherly exhortations. Strive to excel, she urged Charles. Anything worth doing was worth doing well, she reminded them. Learning was not attained by chance, but must be sought for with ardor. She missed her boys more than she could express, and worried more than ever once she learned of the move to Holland, a country so damp, abounding in stagnant water, the air of which is said to be very unfriendly to foreigners. She tried to keep an even balance in her outlook, she told John. I am not suddenly elated or depressed. I know America capable of anything she undertakes with spirit and vigor. No effort was too great for peace, no cost too dear, she wrote. And he must never doubt that his own part in serving that end meant everything to her. My whole soul is absorbed in the idea. The honor of my dearest friend, the welfare and happiness of this wide extended country, ages yet unknown, depend for their happiness and security upon the able and skillful, the honest and upright discharge of the important trust committed to him. It would not become me to write the full flow of my heart upon this occasion. Of the ordeal of separation, she said in closing, I am inured, but not hardened, to the painful portion. Shall I live to see it otherwise? Her letters were his great delight, he had assured her, so long as she did not complain, and she was determined to oblige. I am wholly unconscious of giving you pain in this way since your late absence, she wrote as the second winter approached. If I complained before, it was from the ardor of affection which could not endure the least apprehension of neglect. Sure I am that not a syllable of complaint has ever stained my paper in any letter I have ever written since you left me. On Christmas Day, 1780, longing for him, she had written a letter he would not receive until nearly summer. My dearest friend, how much is comprised in that short sentence? How fondly can I call you mine, bound by every tie which consecrates the most inviolable friendship, yet separated by a cruel destiny? I feel the pangs of absence sometimes too sensibly for my own repose. There are times when the heart is peculiarly awake to tender impressions, when philosophy slumbers or is overpowered by sentiments more conformable to nature. It is then that I feel myself alone in the wide world, without anyone to tenderly care for me or lend me an assisting hand through the difficulties that surround me. Yet my cooler reason disapproves the ripening thought and bids me bless the hand from which my comforts flow. Man, active, resolute, and bold, is fashioned in a different mold. More independent by nature, he can scarcely realize all those ties which bind our sex to his. Is it not natural to suppose that as our dependence is greater, our attachment is stronger? I find in my own breast a sympathetic power always operating upon the near approach of letters from my dearest friend. I cannot determine the exact distance when this secret charm begins to operate. The time is sometimes longer, sometimes shorter. The busy sylphs are ever at my ear. No sooner does Morpheus close my eyes than my whole soul unbounded flies to thee. Am I superstitious enough for a good Catholic? A Mr. Ross, John Ross, a merchant from Nantes, arrived lately at Philadelphia and punctually delivered your letters. At the same time, a vessel arrived from Holland, which brought me yours from Amsterdam on the 25th of September, which Mr. Lovell was kind enough to forward to me. I have written to you largely since Davis, Captain Edward Davis of the Dolphin, arrived here, though not in reply to the letters brought by him, for old Neptune alone had the handling of them. He was chased by British cruisers and foolishly threw all his letters into the sea, to my no small mortification. How many of Adams's letters had indeed been lost to Neptune, there was no reckoning. But for reasons unknown, and perhaps unknown even to him, Adams appears to have been writing to her hardly at all. In the first half of 1781, to judge by the letters she received, he wrote only once in the first 3 months and briefly. Then, briefly again in April, to say he had taken a house in Amsterdam beside the Kaisersgracht. Another letter followed in May, another in June, which made 4 letters in 6 months and all mostly matter of fact, except that once he wrote, "Oh, oh, oh, that you were here!" He told her little of his work, or about the boys. Nothing, for example, of the fact that Charles had been severely ill at Leiden. It was all as if his concentration and energy were taken up by his dogged struggle. In the grip of constant uncertainty and stress, and having no successes to report, he preferred to keep silent. He was as preoccupied as he had ever been, and miserably unhappy. And in such a state of mind, as time would show, he was often disinclined to write to her. He abandoned his diary. Only to John Quincy, interestingly, did he pour forth in customary fashion in letters filled with advice and affection. In the time he had spent with his eldest son since the voyage of the Boston, it had become clear to Adams that the boy was not only exceptionally bright, but capable of concentrated work to a degree well beyond his years, a judgment confirmed by Benjamin Waterhouse, who wrote of John Quincy bearing down on his lessons with a constancy rarely seen at that age. There was no longer a problem of language for the boy, since university lectures were conducted in Latin. "You are now at a university where many of the greatest men have received their education," Adams reminded him. He must attend all the lectures possible in law, medicine, chemistry, and philosophy. He must make a study of all the departments and regulations of the celebrated university, everything in it that may be initiated in the universities of your own country. Yet when John Quincy asked if he might buy ice skates that winter, Adams consented without hesitation, explaining that skating should be considered a fine art. "It is not simple velocity or agility that constitutes the perfection of it, but grace." Of riding, fencing, and dancing he also approved, adding, "Everything in life should be done with reflection." He sent a gift of several volumes of Pope and a fine edition of a favorite Roman author, Terence, in both Latin and French. "Terence is remarkable for good morals, good taste, and good Latin," Adams advised. "His language has simplicity and an elegance that make him proper to be accurately studied as a model." On hearing that John Quincy's course of studies did not include Cicero and Demosthenes, Adams could hardly contain his indignation. "John Quincy must begin upon them at once," he declared. "I absolutely insist upon it." If forced to it, he would bring John Quincy back from Leiden and teach him himself. Adams was writing about what he so dearly loved to the son he so dearly loved. That he was raising the boy to serve his country one day, there was never a question. Latin and Greek were not all that mattered. John Quincy must neither forget nor fail to enjoy the great works of his own mother tongue, and especially those of the poets. It was his happiness, too, that mattered. "Read somewhat in the English poets every day. You will find them elegant, entertaining, and constructive companions through your whole life. In all the disquisitions you have heard concerning the happiness of life, has it ever been recommended to you to read poetry? You will never be alone with a poet in your pocket. You will never have an idle hour. You will ever remember that all the end of study is to make you a good man and a useful citizen, Adam said at the close of a letter in May. This will ever be the sum total of the advice of your affectionate father. At Paris and Philadelphia all the while, movements were underway to dislodge John Adams as sole American peacemaker in Europe. Distressed by the mounting cost of the war, Vergennes was ready to see it concluded, and if need be, to compromise with Britain on the question of American independence. Since he could not have the intractable Adams standing in the way, the French foreign minister sent specific instructions to La Luzerne to do whatever necessary to have Adams removed. La Luzerne, who had become a figure of conspicuous importance in Philadelphia, his influence with Congress as great as that of anyone, worked assiduously. With money to spend, he bribed at least one member of Congress, General John Sullivan, and possibly others besides. Benjamin Franklin's letter of August 9th, describing Vergennes' displeasure with Adams, had only recently arrived in Philadelphia and ignited sharp debate. On one side were those like Samuel Adams and James Lovell, who strongly supported John Adams's independent spirit and were unwilling that the United States give way always to the wishes of the French. On the other side stood those like John Witherspoon and young James Madison of Virginia, who trusted the French and believed French friendship and support of such crucial importance that nothing should be allowed to put the alliance at risk, and who had little faith in John Adams's stiffness and tenaciousness of temper, as Witherspoon said in his clipped Scottish way. Appearing before a congressional committee considering the conduct of Mr. Adams, La Luzerne stated the need for an American plenipotentiary who would take no step without the approbation of His Majesty, and who, furthermore, would receive his directions from the Comte de Vergennes. On June 15, 1781, after hours of argument, Congress agreed to be governed by the dictates of the French court. John Adams's powers as sole peacemaker with Britain were revoked. He was not to be recalled, as Vergennes wished and as La Luzerne had nearly succeeded in bringing about. Instead, he was to be one of five commissioners, each representing a major section of the country. Adams for New England, Franklin for Pennsylvania, John Jay for New York, Jefferson for Virginia, and Henry Laurens for the Deep South. But with Jay in Spain, Henry Laurens locked up in the Tower of London, Jefferson unlikely to leave Virginia, and Adams tied down with his assignment in Holland, there remained only Franklin to serve as the American negotiator at Paris, exactly as Vergennes desired. Further, it was determined in a secret session of Congress that the commissioners were to do nothing in the negotiations for peace without the knowledge and concurrence of the ministers of their generous ally, the King of France. Thus, all decisions were subject to the approval of Foreign Minister Vergennes. In treating with the British, France was to have the final say. Again, exactly as Vergennes wished. Congressman Thomas Rodney of Delaware, who had fought the measure, wrote that night to his older brother Caesar, "I think it must convince even the French court that we are reduced to a weak and abject state, and that we have lost all that spirit and dignity which once appeared in the proceedings of Congress." A few weeks later, and again in secret session, on a motion from James Madison, Adams's second prior commission, to negotiate a treaty of commerce with Britain, was also revoked. At Braintree, Abigail had picked up word that Franklin was blacking the character of John Adams. "You will send me, by first opportunity, the whole of this dark process," she wrote straight away to James Lovell, and then let fly in a fury with her pen. Seldom in history has a wife so stoutly risen in defense of her good man. Was the man Adams a gallant? I should think he had been monopolizing the women of the Enchanter, Franklin. Was he a modern courtier? I should think he had outwitted him in court intrigue. Was he a selfish, avaricious, designing, deceitful villain? I should think he had encroached upon the old gentleman's prerogatives. "It needs great courage, sir, to engage in the cause of America," she added, fiercely proud of her Mr. A. "He is a good man. Would to heaven we had none but such in office. You know, my friend, that he is a man of principle, and that he will not violate the dictates of his conscience to ingratiate himself with a minister or with your more respected body. Yet it wounds me, sir. When he is wounded, I bleed." In early summer 1781, Francis Dana received notification from Congress that he was to proceed from Holland to St. Petersburg to seek recognition of the United States by the government of the Empress Catherine the Great of Russia. As Dana spoke little French and would need secretarial help, he asked Adams if John Quincy might accompany him. It would be an expedition of nearly 1,200 miles to a capital city few Americans had ever seen. But Adams thought highly of Dana. The boy excelled at French, and the experience, Adams felt, would stand him well for the future. At the same time, Adams decided that young Charles, whose health remained uneven and who had become desperately homesick for his mother, should return to her in the care of Benjamin Waterhouse, who was on his way back to Boston. "I consented to the departure of both boys, and thus deprived myself of the greatest pleasure I had in life," Adams later wrote. But before either departed, Adams himself was off to Paris. Summoned by Vergennes to take part in discussions of a possible mediation of the war by Russia and Austria. Nothing was more abhorrent to Adams than the prospect of a truce determined by France and other European powers, and he headed south gravely worried. John Quincy was gone on a long journey with Mr. Dana as an interpreter, was as much as he reported to Abigail in a letter from Paris dated July 11th, John Quincy's 14th birthday. Charles was coming home, he also told her, but how or when he did not say, as probably he dared not for the boy's safety. "He is a delightful child, but has too exquisite sensibility for Europe." He himself was distracted with more cares than ever, he wrote, "yet I grow fat. Anxiety is good for my health, I believe." To Adams's immense relief, the discussions at Paris came to nothing, and by the month's end he was back in Holland in time to spend a few weeks with Charles. In mid-August, the 11-year-old boy sailed on the South Carolina, which, after a troubled voyage, put in at La Coruña, Spain, where eventually he sailed on another American ship, Cicero, a privateer, and after more delays and adventures reached home at the end of January 1782, more than 5 months after leaving Amsterdam. Adams was by then established in his commodious new residence in Amsterdam on the Kaisersgracht. While not so grand as the houses along the Herengracht, the next canal nearest the center of the city, it was, as he had requested, perfectly fit for the Hôtel des États-Unis d'Amérique, a fine red-brick canal house, 5 stories tall, with a handsome front door at the top of a short flight of stone steps. There was a deep garden to the rear, and the view from the large front windows included a pretty little arched bridge that crossed the Kaisersgracht at the nearby corner at Spiegelstraat, or Looking Glass Street. In the sunshine of summer, the trees bordering the canal cast lovely shadows on the water and on the facades of houses on the opposite side. But to Adams, absorbed in his work, the outlook was bleak. Try as he could, the Dutch seemed to care only for their own commercial self-interests. He wondered if they were a people deficient in heart. On August 24th, with the arrival of a packet of letters from Congress sent on by Franklin from Paris, Adams learned that his commission as peacemaker had been revoked and a new commission established. He tried to maintain a good front. Congress may have done very well to join others in the Commission for Peace who have some faculties for it, he wrote to Franklin. My talent, if I have one, lies in making war. Exhausted, his sons gone, Francis Dana gone, and with no reason to think his mission to Holland anything but a failure, Adams fell ill. Nothing more was heard from him for 6 weeks. The illness, mild at first, grew steadily worse to the point that he lay near death in the house by the canal. Several leading physicians came and went. For several days, he lost consciousness. Not until October was he able to draft a letter, to say he had fallen victim to a nervous fever, the common, if imprecise, term used by the attending physicians. His fullest description of what happened would be to Abigail in a letter of October 9th, when he was just barely able to hold a pen. Soon after my return from Paris, I was seized with a fever, of which, as the weather was and had long been uncommonly warm, I took little notice. But it increased very slowly and regularly, until it was found to be a nervous fever of a dangerous kind, bordering on putrid. It seized upon my head in such a manner that for 5 or 6 days I was lost, and so insensible to the operations of the physicians and surgeons as to have lost the memory of them. My friends were so good as to send me an excellent physician and surgeon, whose skill and faithful attention with the blessing of heaven saved my life. I am, however, still weak, and whether I shall be able to recover my health among the pestilential vapors from these stagnant waters, I know not. Writing a week later to the new President of Congress, Thomas McKean, Adams added that the doctors had administered the all-powerful Peruvian bark, quinine, and that this, too, had helped to save him from a nervous fever of a very malignant kind. To his Dutch colleague, Charles Dumas, Adams wrote that, "My feet had well-nigh stumbled on dark mountains," and that he had recovered only through the wondrous virtue of Peruvian bark. In medical texts of the time, nervous fever or slow nervous fever was defined as an insidious and dangerous malady that began with listlessness, followed by chills, flushes of heat, and a kind of weariness all over, like what is felt after a great fatigue. "This is always attended with a sort of heaviness and dejection of spirit," wrote Dr. John Huxham, fellow of the Royal College of Physicians at Edinburgh, in a treatise published in 1779. "The head grows more heavy or giddy, the pulse quicker. In this condition, the patient often continues for 5 or 6 days. About the 7th or 8th day, the giddiness, pain, or heaviness of the head become much greater, and this frequently brings on delirium. Now nature sinks apace." Most susceptible to the disease, it was thought, were those of weak nerves, or who had experienced a long dejection of spirits, or had been confined long in damp and foul air. Quite possibly, Adams had fallen victim to malaria, which in the heat of summer could be rampant in European seaports. Later, he would tell Abigail that the fever had burnt up half his memory and half his spirits. Like headache, fatigue, chills, and hot flashes, a subsequent depression or melancholia is also characteristic of the disease, which was thought then to emanate from stagnant water or foul air, miasma. But in fact, as would be learned a century later, is transmitted by mosquitoes. But his nervous fever could also have been typhus, a disease characterized by high fever and delirium and transmitted by lice. That Adams's fatigue and dejection of spirits of that summer could have made him vulnerable to such a collapse is certainly possible. Notwithstanding his claim to Abigail to the contrary, anxiety was not at all good for his health. He himself would later say that excessive fatigue and anxiety concerning the state of his affairs in Holland, as well as the unwholesome damps of the night, had brought him as near to death as any man ever approached without being grasped in his arms. More than a month would pass before Adams felt reasonably well again, and some symptoms of the fever would drag on or recur long afterward, another characteristic of malaria. 6 months later, he would write of his fever and feeble knees. A year and a half later, he would tell Abigail the consequences of Amsterdam fever were still plaguing him. In addition, others in the house, Thaxter, Stevens, and another of the servants, were stricken in the same way, which did little to improve the atmosphere. Adams would describe Stevens, a robust man who had never been ill, as almost shaken to pieces by fever, reduced almost to a shadow. In all, it was as low a time as Adams ever knew. His first letter to anyone, even before his letter to Abigail, was to Franklin on October 4th, and in John Thaxter's hand. Only Adams's signature was his own. Having explained his long silence, he again stressed his acceptance of the new five-man peace commission, claiming he had actually been consoled by the change during the weeks when it appeared he might have nothing more ever to do with commissions of any sort. Particularly, he had been thinking about Jefferson, and was eager to know if Franklin had any further word. "Have you any information concerning Mr. Jefferson, whether he has accepted the trust, whether he has embarked or proposes to embark? I saw a paragraph in a Maryland paper which expressed apprehension that he was taken prisoner by a party of horse cavalry in Virginia." In reply, Franklin expressed sincere concern for Adams's health and said that while he had no further information on Jefferson, he very much doubted the truth of the story of his having been taken prisoner. In mid-October, so low he could see no hope or purpose in anything, Adams wrote as downhearted a letter as any he ever sent to Congress. His efforts to raise money were useless, his health wretched, his life in Europe so gloomy and melancholy, and of such little use to the public, that I cannot but wish it may suit with the views of Congress to recall me. It was, as he doubtless knew, a request Congress would ignore. Gradually, his strength returned, his outlook improved. If nothing else, he could take his new reduced status as peace commissioner gallantly, put a good face on the matter, show no anger or disappointment, no animosity toward Congress or toward Franklin, and he urged Abigail to do the same. "Don't distress yourself about any malicious attempts to injure me in the estimation of my countrymen. Let them take their course and go the length of their tether," he wrote. "The contemptible essays made by you-know-whom will only tend to their own confusion. Say as little about it as I do." He longed for his dearest friend. "What a fine affair it would be if we could flit across the Atlantic as they say the angels do from planet to planet. I would dart to Penn's Hill and bring you over on my wings." "Ah, my dear John, where are you?" She was writing at home at almost the same time. "2 years, my dearest friend, have passed away since you left your native land." She was buying land in the new state of Vermont, she told him, a retreat in the woods where they could retire from the vexations and hazards of public life. In fact, she was well on the way to accumulating more than 1,000 acres in Vermont. "Do you not sometimes sigh for such a seclusion?" she asked him. There was talk of a future role for him in Massachusetts politics, but she had no such ambition. "I know the voice of fame to be a mere weathercock, unstable as water and fleeting as a shadow." Yet she did have pride, she conceded. "I know I have a large portion of it." Her Vermont plans interested him not at all. "God willing, I will not go to Vermont," he would write. "I must be within the scent of the sea." At the end of November came sensational news. On Friday, October 19, 1781, at Yorktown, Virginia, by Chesapeake Bay, the British General Cornwallis had surrendered his army to a combined American and French force under Washington and Rochambeau. It was as decisive a defeat of the British as Saratoga, and made possible by the arrival of Admiral de Grasse with the French West Indies fleet of 28 ships of the line at exactly the right place at exactly the right time. The British had been trapped, just as Washington would have been on Long Island early in the war had the British fleet been able to close off the East River. More than 7,000 British troops had put down their arms, more even than at Saratoga. To many on both sides of the Atlantic, it presaged a quick end to the war. In America, in the first flush of victory, Washington was hailed as the deliverer of his country. In London, the British Prime Minister, Lord North, exclaimed, "Oh God, it's all over." Adams received the glorious news at Amsterdam the night of November 23rd. He was elated and took untold satisfaction from the knowledge that French sea power, after all, had proved decisive. It had been nearly 3 years since he told Vergennes that nothing would so guarantee a speedy conclusion to the war as a powerful French fleet in American waters. And now it had come to pass exactly as he had said. Adams did not see Yorktown as the end of the struggle, however. The British still occupied major ports, including New York, and there would be no peace, he was sure, as long as a single company of British soldiers were at liberty anywhere in the United States. But if Yorktown did not mean an end to the war, it changed everything in Holland, as Adams saw at once. The chance to achieve his goal of Dutch recognition and financial support would never be better. Dutch merchants had no wish to be on the losing side. Still feebled in health, he immediately met with the Duc de la Vauguyon, and by mid-December could happily report to Congress that the French ambassador himself had said it was time Adams demanded an answer to his memorial of April, and do all in his power to secure a Dutch loan. "He thinks that I may now assume a higher tone, which the late Cornwallization will well warrant." As the new year commenced, Adams was at The Hague audaciously demanding a categorical answer. The president of the week, Bartholomeus von den Sonthuyvel, reported Adams's inquiry to their high mightinesses, the States General, and so the question of American independence and Dutch-American relations became a matter of political debate throughout the country. Adams then, in effect, took his case to the people of the Netherlands, calling for citizen petitions to the government for recognition of the United States. And at the moment, when popular sentiment against Britain was strongly on the rise, he went personally to the individual residences at The Hague for the delegations of 18 cities in the province of Holland, each of which, as he explained to Congress, could be considered an independent republic. At every house, the reception was the same: approval, affection, esteem for the United States. Clearly, the campaign that he and his collaborators, Luzak, Dumas, von der Capellen, had launched to educate the Dutch people about the United States and its cause had not been in vain. Nor did the collaborators cease to press for action. Von der Capellen in particular warned that alienating the Americans could damage trade with them, and that it would be quite unwise to offend any further someone of such rectitude and importance as John Adams. "I know the unflinching character of Mr. Adams," he wrote. "I know that it has been a sore point, and I shudder for the consequences if we embitter a man of his influence, one of the principal founders of American freedom." With the outlook brighter than it had ever been, Adams began receiving communications from Robert R. Livingston, who had been newly elected by Congress as the first foreign secretary, a choice the French ambassador, La Luzerne, boasted with some exaggeration to the Comte de Vergennes that he himself had arranged. Strongly allied with those in Congress who were well disposed toward the French, Livingston regarded Adams as imprudent and considered his April 19th memorial to the Dutch court a ridiculous display. In November, he demanded that Adams explain his actions, and in a tone bound to infuriate Adams. "We learned from Mr. Dumas that you have presented your credentials to the States General. We are astonished that you have not written on so important a subject and developed the principles that induced you to declare your public character before the States were disposed to acknowledge it." In a vigorous response, dated February 26th, Adams recounted and explained his conduct in detail. The memorial had been exactly what the situation called for. The opposition of the Duke de la Vauguyon at the time had only confirmed the necessity of it. As for criticism of his own vanity or of his militia diplomacy, he wrote, "The charge of vanity is the last resort of little wits and mercenary quacks, the vainest men alive, against me and measures that they can find no other objection to. I have long since learned that a man may give offense and yet succeed." It was a remarkable letter, lucid, knowledgeable, and candid, if flagrantly self-congratulatory. Warming to the subject of his memorial, he portrayed it as the great catalyst for turning the entire point of view of the Dutch and thus affecting all Europe. But then he recovered himself and with appealing self-deprecation evoked a favorite image from Aesop. "What dust we raise," said the fly upon the chariot wheel. "It is impossible not to prove that this whole letter is not a similar delusion to that of the fly." On February 26, 1782, the northern province of Friesland voted to instruct its delegates in the States General to move formally to receive John Adams as minister from the United States. "Friesland is said to be a sure index of national sense," Adams reported to Robert Livingston. "I am told that the Frisians never undertake anything but they carry it through." Certain that full Dutch recognition was at hand, Adams and Charles Dumas purchased what they anticipated would be the American embassy at The Hague, a large, elegant house on the Fluvelenburgwal, Street of the Velvet Makers, beside one of the city's most beautiful canals. "Your humble servant has lately grown much into fashion in this country," Adams reported to Abigail, having at last genuinely good news for her. "Some folks will think your husband a negotiator, but it is not to be. It is General Washington at Yorktown who did the substance of the work. The form only belongs to me." On March 20th in London, in a dramatic appearance in the House of Commons, Lord North resigned, to be succeeded by Lord Rockingham, a friend of America whose earlier ministry had repealed the Stamp Act. In a great shift of government, Charles James Fox, who was known to favor immediate recognition of American independence, became Foreign Secretary, and to the post of Secretary of Colonial Affairs was named Lord William Shelburne, who, though he opposed American independence, sent a retired Scottish merchant named Richard Oswald to Paris to sound out Benjamin Franklin on the prospect of negotiations. In the Netherlands, the tide turned on March 28th, when the province of Holland recognized American independence. In rapid order, the other provinces followed suit. On Friday, April 19th, a year to the day since Adams presented his memorial, the States General resolved that Mr. Adams shall be admitted and acknowledged in the quality of Ambassador of the United States to their High Mightinesses. When the following day Adams came to the assembly to present his letter of credence, it was as sweet a moment of triumph and vindication as he had ever known. On Monday, April 22nd, at the Huis ten Bosch Palace at The Hague, Adams was received by His Most Serene Highness the Prince of Orange, William V, and his wife, Princess Wilhelmina, in a ceremony of formal recognition. The day after, as Adams took particular pleasure in informing Robert Livingston, the French ambassador made an entertainment for the Corps Diplomatique in honor of the United States, at which he introduced their minister to all the foreign ministers of this court, and the Duke de la Vauguyon more than compensated for the stiffness of some of the others by paying more attention to the new brother than to the old fraternity.